Amen. Awesome. Thank you. Okay. Interesting. Let me make sure. I pressed record. Yes, I did. Okay. Three levels of interpretation. What are they? When it was first said, the first vocalization. So first said, what's number two? Yeah, first received or the first audience, right? Number three? Modern reader, and that is a relative term. Modern for whoever it is that's reading at the time period that they're reading. So 1100s, that makes sense. We've spent most of our time here in this class so far. I want us to shift and to develop this a bit before we move into this final one, especially this one will be big time utilized and developed like in our literary analysis and things of that nature, even theology and the things of this nature. But I want to develop this some more. By focusing on something that normally isn't widely celebrated, and that is the dating of the Gospels. There is even an audible groan. Turn to Mark chapter 1, verse 1. Mark chapter 1, verse 1. We're actually going to look at, initially, the dating of the Gospel of Mark as a means by which to have some sort of grounding for the dating of the other ones. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. They were showing me their Bible apps. Sorry, that was really weird for those online. Online, they're like, he's just very excited about himself today. Gospel of Mark, though, is going to be our entry point, but I want to read the first verse. I want to talk about the dating, and then I want to come back to the first verse. Really, not just the first verse, but we're going to be dabbling throughout the Gospel of Mark as a whole and just asking the question this: how does the dating help this? Not the first. We're not dealing with that right now. We've been dealing with that really with the messianic expectation. How does it help with the first received, the first audience? So the ones that received the document. Okay? So Mark 1:1 says, the beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God. That's how it begins. If you have different dates, that verse jumps out in a different way. So what we're going to do is we're going to just look at the Gospel of Mark and its dating as a whole, the traditional debate around it, and we're going to come back to this verse to answer a question at the very end, maybe of today, maybe tomorrow, but the question we'll answer at the end is, does the dating matter for this? For interpretation of the book, does the dating matter? That's what we will eventually answer, okay? Right now, I want to just kind of lay out for us the kind of the dating around the book of Mark. Why the book of Mark is a stopgap for all the other Gospels. Where you end up dating Mark, and there's a lot more discussion and evidence on the dating of Mark than there is all the other Gospels, but where you date the book of Mark, it will determine where you end up dating Matthew, Luke, not necessarily John. John kind of is its own thing. But where you date Mark will impact the other two, and we'll talk about John at the end. Okay? First of all, Mark's author is important for us to keep in mind. Mark's author, throughout church history, external evidence, it's pretty unanimous. Who is it? John Mark. Matter of fact, let me just read from Eusebius Ecclesiastical Histories. You should recognize this. We've read this once for a different purpose. But he's citing Papias, who lived around the time of 60 to 130. He says, Mark, or John Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately, though not indeed in order, whatsoever he remembered of the things done or said by Christ. For he neither heard the Lord nor followed him, but afterward, as I said, he followed Peter, who adapted his teaching to the needs of his hearers, but with no intention of giving a connected account of the Lord's discourses, so that Mark committed no error while he thus wrote some things as he remembered them. For he was careful of one thing, not to omit any of the things which he had heard, and not to state any of them falsely. Summarize the key points of what he just said. What do we know then? Based on what Eusebius, citing Papias, said. What do we know? Mark followed Peter. That's an important component. Therefore, it's not just that John Mark wrote this, but from whose eyes are we receiving these accounts? Peter. From the eyewitness Peter, Peter is preaching in what region? Did you guys catch it in here? Did it say it in there? Or was that one of the later ones? No, it actually never says it in there. Peter is preaching in Rome. Peter is actually imprisoned in Rome at the time, or at least in the region, and will soon be imprisoned. So you're talking around, you know, 62. Really, though, Peter ends up being killed in around 67, 65 to 67. So John Mark's with Peter in Rome while Peter's preaching, and John Mark is taking notes and eventually collects it into the gospel itself. Knowing some of these contours are important because John Mark's a pretty big deal when it comes to the New Testament. Not just the fact that he writes the Gospel of Mark, but Peter in 1 Peter 5:13 calls John Mark my son, spiritual son. He meant a ton to the one that was holding the keys to the kingdom. John Mark also is more, well, he is the son of the woman that more than likely was the owner of the upper room. We definitely know in Acts chapter 12, verse 12, whenever Peter is released by the angel from prison, he goes back to John Mark's home. And it's an upper room where Christians are gathered and praying in Jerusalem, which is one of the reasons why it's a high candidate for being the upper room, where the Lord's Supper occurred. And Barnabas is a cousin of John Mark, coming from Colossians chapter 4, verse 10. Barnabas is even related. And Barnabas is kind of a big deal in the early church, appearing for the first time in Acts chapter 4 when he sells some land and gives all of the money at the apostles' feet for them to distribute out as needed. And then Ananias and Sapphira do their thing in chapter 5 based off of Barnabas' example. He's identified as the son of encouragement. Do you know what tribe he was from? It says in Acts chapter 4, he was a Levite, Barnabas was. A Levite. Barnabas also was from what island? It's important if you know the missionary journeys of the book of Acts. Where's the first island that Paul and Barnabas go to? Sergius Paulus. There's Cyprus. Why do they go to Cyprus first? Because that's Barnabas' home island. He goes there. So Barnabas, kind of a big deal. Barnabas is the one that actually argues with the disciples to get them to accept Saul, who eventually becomes Paul. Barnabas is the one that goes and finds Saul later when he's up in Tarsus. That's John Mark's cousin. And John Mark, we also know because he is on the first missionary journey with Paul and Barnabas, right? What happens? There's something pretty famous that happens there. Yeah. John Mark leaves them. After they finish their little trek in Cyprus and they go north, John Mark at some point leaves them in Pamphylia, leaves them, which causes a big problem for Paul when in Acts chapter 15, after the Jerusalem Council, Barnabas wants to take John Mark, his cousin, on the next journey. And what ends up happening? Paul and Barnabas get so upset at each other about John Mark, they split. John Mark's kind of a big deal. Now, one of the things I also point out is that in Philemon 24 and 2 Timothy 4:11, Paul refers to John Mark as not just a fellow worker, but he even tells Timothy in 2 Timothy, he says, "Only Luke is with me. Get John Mark and bring him with you because he is helpful to me in my ministry." So there is an eventual reconciliation with Paul and with John Mark, where John Mark also becomes very helpful for Paul's ministry, as he will be very helpful for Peter's. So when we're dealing with the Gospel of Mark, we're not just dealing with some random person in the first century that happened to get a good interview as a journalist. We're dealing with somebody that is intricately interwoven into the fabric of the church. John Mark, which understandably gives his gospel a lot of authority. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I'm not afraid, and we'll talk about this in more detail later, but of Mark in priority, that Mark's gospel was written first. I'm not afraid of that. Why? Well, because John Mark is no slouch. It's not like he's just some random guy. He is intricately interwoven with the movers and the shakers of the early church. Now comes the dating. There are two major categories of the dating of the Gospel of Mark. And both of them are contingent upon what you do with the dating of the book of Acts, which is interesting. That the book, that the gospel that is most important for the dating of the other gospels, or especially the other synoptics, its date is contingent upon what you do with the book of Acts. There are two schools of thought in the book of Acts. I'm going to broadly say them, broadly categorize them, and then we're going to get in more detail. Before 70 AD or before AD 70. And, oh man, you guys are awake. After, yeah, then there's the half asleep yep that comes out from the back there. Yep. Before 70, the book of Acts, or after? Now, the before, we can be a little more specific. Usually people that say the book of Acts is written before 70 are actually pushing hard for it to be written in 62. Why that date? Do we know why that date? Do you know why they push it there? Yeah.
Well, that's before a lot of the stuff goes down with the Jews and that kind of thing.
It is. And now your answer there, there's implicit something even in it. In other words, it is before a lot of things go down with the Jews, which would indicate that they're determining the date based on what comes after historically. That in your answer, it's embedded in it. It's a way of them wrestling with the way the book of Acts ends. Turn to Acts chapter 28, verses 30 through 31. At this point in the book of Acts, we've been able, in some sense, to have a rough chronology that we've been able to follow on some level of kind of when Paul was where. And at this point, at the end of the book of Acts, we're in around 61 or 62. That's where we are. We're right around there. 60, 61, 62. For two whole years, Paul stayed there in his own rented house and welcomed all who came to see him. He proclaimed the kingdom of God, which shouldn't surprise us if we read the first chapter of the book of Acts, and taught about the Lord Jesus Christ with all boldness and without hindrance. Kind of an abrupt ending. The book of Acts has just been moving, all these details. I mean, Luke is a meticulous historian. Right? You guys remember this from your freshman year? I mean, my goodness. I mean, in Luke, usually you can count on if Luke says something, even if our historical evidence doesn't even help prop up what Luke says, usually our historical evidence just hasn't caught up with Luke. I mean, Luke is meticulous in historical account. And so when it ends quite abruptly. And it ends at around 61, 62. And that's important because of what happens right after. In 62, we have the martyrdom of James, the Lord's brother. James, the one that gives the verdict in Acts 15 at the Jerusalem Council. James, one of the pillars of the church in Jerusalem. So here's how the argument goes. If Luke is a meticulous historian, and we have big events that happen in 62 and thereafter, he wouldn't have left them out had they happened. That's how it goes. And it actually makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, hear me. I'm going to argue as powerfully and passionately as I can for this initial option, even though I totally disagree with it. But it makes a lot of sense. Because not only is James killed in 62, but Nero's persecution of Christians ramps up in 64. I mean, whenever Rome is burning and people think it's Nero, and Nero has to wiggle out of it, and so he finds this small Jewish sect inside of the city of Rome known as Christians, or that follow, as Tacitus will say, this one named Crestus, although he's talking about what happens in 49. So then he basically blames it on them, and Christians are killed mercilessly. I mean, this is the time when Christians are impaled on a pole and lit on fire in Nero's garden just to light it up at night. Where Christians are dressed up in the skins of animals while animals are released on them that are their predators and begin to just devour them. Christians in Rome at 64, kind of a big deal. And so the argument goes, if that would have already happened, In other words, an argument against after 70, if 64 has already happened, Luke, a meticulous historian, would not have stopped here. He would have kept writing. Because these are big events. Not to mention, you also have the martyrdom of Peter in 65 to 67 or 68. If that would have already happened, Luke would have wrote about it. You also have the martyrdom of Paul, which also dies in around 67, 68. If that would have happened, Luke would have wrote about it. Or the fall of the temple. If the temple would have already fallen, Luke would have wrote about it. Are you seeing this? Is this making sense? Now, I will be honest. It is an argument from silence. We need to acknowledge that. But it is not a ridiculous argument from silence. Based on Luke's sophisticated historian, at least track record, I guess, on some level, a very careful historian, he would not have omitted such significant details. That makes absolutely no sense. And I see it on that level. That actually, I agree with that. That he is not haphazardly recording things. Therefore, we have to have an explanation for why the book of Acts ends the way it ends if you're going to argue for after 70. You have to. If you're going to argue for after 62, you have to. Okay? So then, what is it? Well, they would also argue that it just ends too abruptly, that books just don't end that abruptly, which we'll talk about that later, and frankly, that's oversold. That's not true. The Iliad even ends quite abruptly because there's also a wink and a nod saying because there's something coming. So, I mean, books end abruptly, and that's something in the ancient world that happened quite often. But they'll say that, and I'm okay with that. Then they also suggest, so then why the book of Acts at all? Their argument would be, so why this? Well, because it is a part of Paul's defense. Have you heard this argument before? Paul is going to be going to appear before Nero, which he was promised he would in Acts 23. You will appear before the emperor, and that's what he's in house arrest waiting to do. And the reason why we never get that trial is because it didn't happen, that the book of Acts, or the books, Luke Acts, were written as a defense of Paul in his trial against Nero. Okay, which, on a certain level, let's just stop for a minute and look at this. Does that make sense? Yeah, actually, it's not a ridiculous construction. It makes a lot of sense. Now, I don't think it takes into account all of the evidence, but that does make a lot of sense. Is that fair? Let's shift it a little bit. Part of my problem with the dating of the book of Acts here is because of what we read at the very beginning about the book of Mark. Now, why is it on any level that these two are even in conversation? Why is it that the dating of Acts will affect the dating of Mark? Why? Now that you're going to have to be able to take two or three steps to get there. Yeah, go. Because of its audience, okay. Why else? Yeah? Okay, now wait a minute. You just brought something up. Luke. Why does Luke matter in this equation? Say it again. Okay, so Luke and Acts are tied together because it's a two-volume work, yes? Remember the beginning of Luke writing to Theophilus, and the beginning of Acts writing to Theophilus. So Luke is important because the relationship between Mark and Luke, on some level, is dependent upon where we date Luke and Acts. Now, here's the reality. This is a significant detail or a significant statistic that we will go over in more detail probably either right at the end of next week or the beginning of class after week of E. But Luke and Mark overlap. So this is the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Mark overlap. 48%. 48% of Luke is found in Mark. Now, here's the reality. If any of you wrote an assignment, and I found that your assignment overlapped with somebody else in the class, 48%, what could I assume? Yeah, on some level, I'm thinking plagiarism, and if I'm being generous, I'm going to say maybe they work together. But if I'm getting sentences that are exactly the same. What would be weird is for me to say, they had no interaction. They just happened to write the exact same thing 48% of the time. That would be a weird conclusion, yes? So what we can say with this statistic is this. They interact with each other on some level. There is some sort of interaction between these two. Okay? Now, we will talk about this in more detail later. But the early church was unanimous that it was either Mark or Matthew that was written first, Luke to follow. Mark and Matthew that were written first, Luke to follow. Now, we will have in the 1800s a guy by the name of J.J. Griesbach that will argue for Luke to be before Mark. But he's in the 1800s, and we'll talk about him later. The majority of scholars say Matthew and Mark written first, and Luke takes from them. As a matter of fact, Matthew and Mark, between each other, 92% overlap. 92% of Mark is found in Matthew. And when you add Luke, 95% of Mark is found in Matthew and Luke. Did you hear that? Dependency from one direction to another. Now, if you have a 95% of your book is found in the two other books, it's more than likely that your book was written first and they're pulling from you. Because it'd be really weird if you created a book and you pulled that much from the other two. 95% of your book is borrowed? That would be weird. Does that make sense? Now again, we're going to talk about the synoptic problem in more detail later. The whole point is right now is to say this. What we do with Luke, or what we do with Acts affects Mark because of Luke's interaction with the book of Mark. Okay? We follow me? Now, the external evidence of Mark on its dating is pretty clear. It's pretty consistent. Whether I'm looking at Papias, or if I'm looking at the anti-Marcionite prologue, or if I'm looking at later in Eusebius, the consistent narrative is this. John Mark is writing for Peter in Rome before Peter's execution. When is Peter in Rome? When is Peter executed? Look at your notes. Yeah, anywhere from 65 to 68. So now what does that do? See, because normally if we're going pre-70, if we say Acts has to be completed by 62, then when is Luke? Luke usually is late 50s, early 60s by this initial date. And then, what do we do with Mark? Well, if Luke is depending on Mark, we need a couple of more years in order for Mark to be written, for Luke to have it. So, Mark's gospel gets dated by this date to the early to mid-50s. Now, that makes sense on some level, if you ignore all the external evidence of Mark's dating. You see my initial pushback? My initial pushback is, you've taken Mark, and based on your date of Acts, you have pushed Mark all the way back to anywhere from 50 to 55. But when I look at the external evidence, when is Peter in Rome? Mid to late 60s, 10 to 15 years difference. And why is it this? Well, it's not based off of the external evidence, it's based on their definition of the book of Acts. That dating. Is this making sense? You got to track with this in order for this to pay off, I promise. It will pay off. So where you date Acts, if you date it to 62, it affects how you date Mark. And if you affect the date of Mark, it affects the way that you date Matthew and Luke. Okay? We good so far, tracking? Any questions about this before I start to build this case? Yeah. Matthew and Mark. There's 92% of Mark in Matthew. And when you add Luke to the equation, then there's 95% of Mark in Matthew and Luke. Yes, I said that right.
You said 95%?
95% of Mark is found in Matthew and Luke. So he has about 4.8% of unique material that's not found in either one of the synoptics. At some point, you understand why there's something called the synoptic problem. You have to engage those statistics. Yeah, I mean, If Turnitin would give me any of those statistics for you all, I would pin you to the wall. Does that make sense? And we'll talk about that more later, but come on. 92%, 95%, 48%. 48% I'd nail you to the wall. I'm going, come on, you can explain that. 92%, I'm just like, okay, this is silly. Why am I even talking to you? You fail. Like, you know what I mean? So we have to explain this on some level. The interdependence is too clear. Okay? So what I'm basically arguing is this. What if instead of the ending of Acts as our beginning point, what if we allowed the external evidence of Mark to be our beginning point? Then what does it do? Do you see why that's an important move? Because if the external evidence, Eusebius, Papias, anti-Marcionite prologue, is all pointing towards Mark being written in this time period, then what happens if I allow it to be written this time period? What does that then do? What problems does it create? What things does it solve? As a matter of fact, one of the things I will also push is the difference between Mark and Luke, specifically at one parallel account. Now, there are multiple ones where I could point to, but this one to me is the most clear. But you have, and technically you have it in Matthew as well, but you have Mark 13, which is parallel to Matthew 24, parallels Luke 21 pretty significantly. It's known as the Olivet Discourse. The Olivet Discourse. And the Olivet Discourse is talking about the destruction of the temple. It even invokes this language of, when you see the abomination of desolation draw near, get out of Dodge. So it's describing the events leading up to and surrounding the destruction of the temple, which is a key important date for our dating, right? Now let's look at this. Look at Mark chapter 13, verse 14. And we're going to compare it to Luke chapter 21, verses 20 and 21. But Mark 13, 14, let's start there. And whenever we turn to Luke 21, I'm going to encourage you to keep your finger there in Mark 13 so that you can flip back to it and see how parallel the language is. Okay? Mark 13, 14. When you see the abomination that causes desolation standing where it does not belong, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Okay? So let me read it one more time so you can get the language embedded in your mind. When you see the abomination that causes desolation standing where it does not belong, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Mark 13, 14. Does it identify what the abomination of desolation is? No. It's pretty vague, yeah? Matthew 24 is the same way. But it's pretty vague, where you're kind of like, okay, well, whenever it's standing where it doesn't belong, I mean, even the location of it, I mean, you can guess it's temple related, but not exactly sure what we're talking about here, so I guess it'll be apparent whenever it comes at this level. When he's first saying it, it's even more vague. When he says it here, it hopefully will be more clear, but we definitely know that by the time we get here, we should be able to solve this where the abomination of desolation issue stands, right? Look at Luke 21. Keep your finger there in Mark 13 because you're going to want to see the parallel language. Luke 21, verses 20 through 21. Luke 21, 20 through 21. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Did you catch that? It uses the word desolation intentionally. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Do you see the parallel language? Do you see it? Especially that last phrase, that last line. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. They're basically saying the exact, well, they are. That sentence is verbatim. That's one of your big time 48% sentences. Okay? But notice the language right before that. You know the desolation is near. But what does Luke do that Mark doesn't do? It adds some details. Identifies what it is. Armies surrounding Jerusalem. Now that's fascinating to me for a couple of reasons. Number one, well, first of all, hear me very clearly. Do I believe that God can predict in detail things before they happen? Let me tell you, just from a yes, okay? I believe he can. Why? If he can have a virgin birth, I think he can tell the future. Okay, I think we're okay. I mean, if he can create everything out of nothing, I think he can figure out what could happen or what will happen in detail. Okay, I think he's capable. But I'm asking this question. Is it necessary for us to posit that's what he's doing in Luke 21, given what we have in Mark 13? And the parallel in Mark 24, when you bring up Mark 24, it's almost exactly what we see in Mark 13. Now, Matthew was an eyewitness. Mark is talking to Peter as an eyewitness. Where is Luke getting his sources? Kind of from anywhere he can, right? So there's either a couple of things that have happened here. Either number one, Luke is maybe more inspired than Mark and Matthew, which is a little weird. Or Luke found some details and cracked a code before it happened that Matthew and Mark, even though they were eyewitnesses, couldn't crack. It's a little strange. Or, wait for it, Luke's writing after the event and is able to fill in some of the details that Mark and Matthew were pointing towards. That's possible. I'm not saying it has to be. I'm just saying it's possible. Because let's be honest, when you compare the two, Luke 21 does have more details. When the army surrounds the city of Jerusalem. And that's actually exactly what happened. As a matter of fact, it was towards the beginning of the revolt of the Jews. And what you had was Cestius Gallus coming up from Syria with a legion. Matter of fact, it was called the Thundering Legion, the Fulminata, the 13th Legion, which was coming down. That's fascinating because their symbol was a pig, which, you know, if you look at the Gerasene demoniac, that's quite fascinating parallel. But they are coming down from Syria. They end up pushing. They surround the city of Jerusalem. They actually even push through the city, the walls, and make it up to the temple itself. They start to light the temple walls on fire when all of a sudden Cestius Gallus, out of nowhere, calls off the whole thing. He says, stop, they've learned their lesson, let's retreat. Upon retreating, the Jewish rebels get emboldened. They attack this legion, virtually wipe the legion out. But then Josephus says this. He says, after Cestius Gallus and the Roman soldiers left, he says, Jews began to abandon Jerusalem like a sinking ship. They started leaving. As a matter of fact, Eusebius will say it was at that moment that Christians began to flee Jerusalem to Pella. Why? Because they had seen the abomination that causes desolation standing where it doesn't belong in the city itself. Or as Luke describes it, armies surrounding the city of Jerusalem. Is this making sense? In other words, is it possible that Luke's just more inspired? Yeah, I mean, I guess. But it's not necessary. What if Luke's writing after the event and can look back on it and give more details than what they were able to have the moment that they were that it was said? Is this making sense? So it's a what if. I'm not saying it solidifies anything. It's a what if. Now, here's why that what if is interesting to me. Because that what if would make a lot of sense if I allow Mark's gospel dating to influence where I put Luke and not the opposite. If Mark's gospel dating is mid to late 60s, and then Luke uses Mark, where is Luke going to be writing around or maybe shortly thereafter? It's going to be right around after this. So if he's writing after this, I'm going to expect not only that he's not forgetting historical details, but maybe he's even giving more acute details looking back on some events. Like a destruction of the temple. Is this making sense? Not asking if you agree with me, because I didn't ask if you agreed with this first one either. I'm asking, does it make sense? Yes?
Is there a consensus on this?
Or what do you mean by consensus?
Do people agree, or more people in the after 70 camp, or more people in the before 70 camp?
And by people, I'm assuming you're meaning scholars?
Yeah.
And I would say scholars would probably fall more after 70, but where do they put it after 70? That's pretty broad.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to, well, I'll get to that in just a minute. I guess I can tell you. I argue that the book of Mark is written around this time period, because I'm thinking Papias and Eusebius and the Anti-Marcionite Prologue know what they're talking about. I think Luke is written probably anywhere, I'm comfortable with any date around late 70s all the way up to the early 90s, Luke Acts. That's right, I'm okay with any of that area. Why? Well, because a lot of some of the stuff that you find in Luke Acts and what was happening during the Flavian dynasty during that time. And so we'll talk about that in more detail in a minute. But there is also something else I think we need to point out with Luke Acts. Not only is Luke a really good historian, he's literarily beautiful. One of the things that you find is Peter and Paul, they parallel each other in miracles. Like Peter has this weird miracle of a shadow, you know, is casting on people and it's healing them. And then Paul has this interesting miracle where people are grabbing his, you know, handkerchief and they're being healed. You also have Peter who resurrects someone from the dead, and then you have Paul with Eutychus resurrecting someone from the dead. Peter healing the lame man that has been lame from birth, and then you have Paul doing the same. They're paralleling each other. And each of their miracles also parallels one of those miracles done by Jesus in the first volume of Luke Acts. The woman touching the hem of Jesus' robe, him resurrecting the young girl, the man that was lame from birth. Is this making sense? In other words, the reason why Peter and Paul parallel each other is because the closer you get to Christ, the more you look like him. See what he's doing? One of the things that's super fascinating is Jesus has, in Luke's gospel, 5 times he is declared innocent in some sort of courtroom setting. Jesus, 5 times. Same thing with Paul. When Paul is leading up to his eventual shipwreck and then his house arrest, 5 times he's declared innocent in some sort of adjudication situation or context. 5 times. So the parallels between Paul and Jesus are pretty significant. You know what is never paralleled between Paul and Jesus? The death, resurrection, and ascension, which are kind of big deals in Luke's gospel. Especially the ascension component, yeah? He makes a pretty big deal out of it, where the other synoptics and John don't really talk about it much at all. But if you're going to parallel Jesus in anything, you would think the death, resurrection, and ascension would get a hearing or get a dominant space. So there's a part of me that the abrupt ending of the book of Acts, I go, that is an abrupt ending. I do have a problem with that. If the book of Acts was supposed to be the last volume, I have a major problem with that. Because it leaves off the 3 most important components. Okay? So let's now go back. I'm going to be putting together some pieces, giving you what I think, but landing on a date so that then we can come back to Mark 1:1. Okay? Is the book of Acts a defense argument before Nero, therefore it needs to be finished by 62? I find that absurd for a couple of reasons. Number one, because of my understanding of Roman courtrooms. The documents of Luke Acts are kind of long. As a matter of fact, Luke Acts together is more material in the New Testament than Paul writes. Luke writes a lot of our New Testament. And in a courtroom setting, to get that type of length and hearing and detail and literary cohesion is weird. Not unprecedented, but weird. Second thing I would say is this. Do we really think that whenever Paul stands before Nero, he's going to let somebody else read a document instead of him preaching? I mean, does that sound like Paul at all? The guy that in Acts 19 was wanting to run into a theater of 25,000 people chanting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," and preach to them. And whenever it comes to Nero, he's like, "I'm glad I'm appearing before Nero, but you take the reins, Luke. Just read your document. I will say nothing." No, a defense before Nero? Paul's going, "You're not going to read a document. I'm preaching to him. I'm going to preach." So the whole idea of this being a defense argument, I'm going, that makes sense if we divorce it from all history and the personalities of the people. But if you add those two in, it kind of seems silly to have Luke Acts be a defense for Paul in a courtroom. Second thing I have a problem with, or that I think that is legitimate, is that, the number one, their abrupt ending of the book of Acts, like I said, in the ancient world, was not unheard of, especially if they were expecting something else to follow. I mean, the Iliad ends abruptly because they know the Odyssey is on its way. Okay? Second one is, I do have a problem with the forgotten details, just like the state does. That we cannot overlook the fact of what happens from 62 to 70 in the life of the church. As a matter of fact, they are so significant, I would actually argue that they would even merit an entire extra volume by themselves. A volume that also paralleled the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. And wouldn't it make sense if we had another volume that the deaths of the Christians, like the death of James, the brother of Jesus, or the killing of Christians in 64, or the martyrdom of Peter and the martyrdom of Paul, were all used as a way of paralleling the death of Jesus himself. And then the destruction of the temple, which was, you know, Jesus makes two predictions that he ultimately uses to even validate and point towards the legitimacy of his resurrection, of his other proclamations, the forgiveness of sins. One prediction was the second coming. One was the destruction of the temple. And I think that in some sense, it's kind of this beautiful irony that the destruction of the temple is actually evidence of the resurrecting of something greater. Which would make a lot of sense if you're writing a volume and you're trying to parallel the death, resurrection. You have these deaths that lead to a resurrection, and the ascension is all about the kingdom that Christ is reigning from in heaven, coming to earth. An exhortation to Christians to go out and be the kingdom that Christ, through his death and resurrection, has accomplished. In other words, I think that based on all the evidence, I think there was a third volume that either Luke intended to write or never, or did write, and we don't have. But to me, it doesn't sound like he stopped accidentally. And especially whenever I'm getting the dating and all the things he leaves off, I'm going, there is something that is incomplete intentionally to be completed. Now, I know we have Acts 29, et cetera, stuff, but I think Luke actually had a third volume in mind that just never came to fruition. Or it did, and we don't have it. Now, I will have people say, well, oh my gosh, well, what does that mean? What do you mean, what does it mean? Like, well, I mean, like, do we not have the whole Bible? What do you mean, the whole Bible? Like, listen, the Holy Spirit has given us exactly what we need in order to know everything that we need to know to become more like Christ and to do his work. We're fine. Okay? Some people will say, like, well, what if we found the document? Okay. Would you vote for it to be in the canon? No. Why not? Because the Holy Spirit's given us everything we need in order to draw closer to Jesus and in order to accomplish his mission. We're okay. It's not like we find the third volume and Luke's going to be like, just kidding about the resurrection. It didn't really happen. That wouldn't happen. We don't need that third volume in order to understand anything. But the concept of a third volume makes a lot of sense, historically speaking. As a matter of fact, sociologically, we even start to ask the question, why is it that every single time in Luke Acts, we see Romans proclaiming the innocence of Jesus or one of the Christians? Because they do. There's not a single time in the book of Luke or Acts where you see a Roman condemning them in a way that they're going, yep, they deserve to be damned. As a matter of fact, what we see a lot of times is Romans jumping the gun, flogging before they know about Roman citizenship. It's indicting on the Romans. They've mistreated Christians over and over and over. And guess what's happening at the beginning in the middle of the 80s? You have a distinct time in which Jews, and I would argue especially Christians, are being mistreated and accusing Christians and Jews of things falsely. I think this document was a way of responding to what was happening in the culture. I think it was Luke's apologia for the existence of the church in a Flavian dynasty that was very hostile towards Jews and Christians. Similar to what Josephus's Antiquities of the Jews ends up being when he's writing in the late 80s, early 90s. So in other words, based on this, now here's why this is important. All that I did was to say this one evidence of internal evidence at the end of the book of Acts is not going to dictate what I do with the book of Mark. I'm going to allow the external evidence of the book of Mark, which is unanimous, to be my starting point. And from my starting point, the book of Mark influences the book of Luke, which is influencing the book of Acts, which ultimately will influence what we do with Matthew as well. Matthew and Luke, because of their 92% overlap, I would have Matthew and Luke a virtual simultaneous, a virtually simultaneous publication. And I think there's reasons for that. I think that actually the Gospel of Mark is the catalyst for gospel writing. Why do I say that? Well, because they actually have to convince Peter that it's even okay to write it down, because written documents were a lot more distrusted in the ancient world than verbal communication. Oral tradition was made way more sense in the ancient world than a written document. Written documents can be tampered with. They can be, it's hard to monitor them. They can be destroyed and it can be lost. But a passing on verbally has worked for hundreds, if not thousands of years at this point, especially for the Jewish people. The people of Rome had to convince Peter that it was a good idea for John Mark to write this down as a memorial of Peter, because they all knew he was about to die. So John Mark begins to write, and I think that Matthew, with his audience in mind, says, that's a good idea. But I think at that point, I'm literally giving you my answer. We will talk about this over the next 3 weeks. But at this point, they had a pretty clear oral transmission, an oral tradition of what the gospel was, which is why you have 92% overlap between these two books. Because it's coming from the same stories that have been talked about the campfire and preached in churches for 50, 40 years, 30 years at that point. And certain narratives, especially ones that are important, take on certain forms, sometimes even very rigid forms, that the community makes sure doesn't deviate. You see, is this making sense? So I think these two, as a matter of fact, there's also the difference between when was a book written as opposed to when was it published, because they were probably writing the book, collecting notes for years before it actually gets out there. But these two being written around the same time, with Luke being written around anywhere from the late 70s to the early 90s, John is something of its own. John is written, so says church tradition, anywhere from 90 to 96. A lot of reasons for that. It's connected to the book of Revelation, but we're not getting into it. Just sorry, we're not. So, that's whenever this one is. Now, here's why this is important. Let's go back to Mark chapter 1, verse 1. The beginning of the good news about Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. If it is written, let's even just say, let's dislodge it from 65 to 68 and just say that it's anywhere before 70 is when the Gospel of Mark is written. So even 69. What's happening in around 68, 69 in the Empire of Rome? Anything of note? Go, yeah. Change of dynasties that's starting to be birthed. Does anybody know what the year 69 was in the history of Rome? The year of the four emperors. In 1 year, four separate emperors, Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian, reign at once, fighting for the throne. Each of them claiming to be the Son of God. The beginning of this new era. Every one of them. Now let's reread Mark 1:1 again. The beginning of the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. You know what also happens at the end of the Gospel of Mark? At Jesus' crucifixion? What do we have? Roman centurion. And in the Greek it says this, surely this man, as opposed to that man, is the Son of God. If you're in 69, 68, and you are receiving this, all of a sudden Mark 1:1 jumps off with a political potency that's pretty astounding. Because in an environment where there's a lot of people claiming to be the Son of God, this book begins by saying, I'm writing about the true Son of God. Are we ready? It takes on a different bite. If it's written in the mid-50s, early 50s, it's just kind of a fun little title. But in the 60s, it takes on a bite, a challenge. That it's not just a challenge to Rome, but a challenge to the Christians living in Rome that have been killed by Rome to stand before Rome faithful even to the point of death. Does dating matter? I think it does. Because without it, we have no idea the colors and contours of the people that are receiving the document when they're receiving it. And if you're in a time period of persecution, suffering, and even death, you will read Mark 1:1 differently than if you're in a time period of peace and tranquility. You just will. Well, we will reflect and process this more in the morning. Love you guys. See you then. You don't have to agree with me to get an A. It's okay.